Welcome to EIR Talks. On January 28, 2003, Democratic Party presidential pre-candidate Lyndon H. LaRouche gave his State of the Union address before a live audience in Washington, D.C. The event was also broadcast on the World Wide Web. This week's show is part three of his strategic intervention into the current crisis, as well as questions and answers from the extended audience.
Let's take the military question. Let's be very plain about this stuff. The policy of the United States should be, and essentially was in many points, the strategic defense concept introduced by Lazar Carnot, a great military genius, engineer and scientist, one of the key figures associated with the so-called École Politique technique of that period. Carnot is also famous between 1792 and 1794, at the time that France was being invaded by virtually every power in Europe and was about to be carved up. That Carnot was given the unlikely position of being the Minister of Defense in the field for France when everybody in Paris assumed that France was going to be dismembered. He, within that period of time, defeated all of the enemies of France and built the most powerful military machine in Europe on the land. He was then, they got rid of him. But he continued to hang around. But he developed this idea of strategic defense as a policy. He based his concept of defense largely on a study he did of the work of a famous French military engineer, Vauban. A couple of years ago, I happened to get into that area. It's on the opposite side of the Rhine in France from a place called Breisach in Germany, near the Rhine. On the other side of the Rhine, there's a city, which is still a functioning small city to this day. It's a fortified city built by Vauban in the earlier part of the 18th century. At a time, given what military artillery could do at those points, is a very formidable construction. And as a result of a similar fortification, Belfort, which is also famous for its role in the Franco-Prussian War, that the Austro-Hungarians, never dared to attack France on that quarter at any time. Because the effectiveness of this principle of fortification, of strategic defense, was so effective, they didn't dare. And therefore, from this, he generalized a concept of strategic defense. This was then amplified later, in the same general period, by a young man who was studying at a military school set up by a Graf Wilhelm Schomburg-Lippe. The school's program was one designed for Schomburg-Lippe by Moses Mendelssohn, the famous Moses Mendelssohn. And this produced Scharnhorst, who was one of the greatest commanders and greatest military thinkers of that period. And the German concept of defense, based on what my dear friend Congressman Rangel would agree about, of a idea of using an in-depth reserve of the population, so as a trained reserve, as the defense of a nation, is what Creighton Admiral did, Abrams did, in terms of the lessons of the Vietnam War, is to take and military units for warfare should be, in a sense, skeleton units filled in by reserves. Therefore, in order to fight a war, the military would be obliged to call up a trained reserve to fill the places assigned to them within the ranks of these units. In that way, you would not go to war, as we did in Vietnam. You would not go to war without challenging the willingness of the population to fight that war. That's the principle. What the problem we have today is we have three ideas of global conflict at hand. The first one, first two are bad. The first one is the baddest. This is a concept developed by the circles of H.G. Wells and Bertrand Russell, which became the idea of nuclear weapons as the road to world government. Russell's argument was, and this is why the bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and for no other reason, MacArthur had won the war. There was never a need for the United States to invade Japan. Never. No million lives were saved by the bombs. None. The whole thing's a hoax. As MacArthur's had already indicated to his staff, that Japan was already defeated and there was no prospect for invading Japan. It's also a classical principle which was taught by Machiavelli, for example, in the 16th century. You don't pursue an already defeated enemy into his hiding hole. You may stumble on the war. sit back and let him surrender. Because the object of war is not war. The object of war is peace, when you can't obtain it by any other means. And therefore, that's the idea of strategic defense, is to have a peace policy, a policy for establishing peaceful relations which are acceptable among nations, and fighting only to ensure that that is not jeopardized. Otherwise, don't fight. But these guys say, no, we want to create a new Roman Empire. What we're going to do is we're going to use nuclear weapons as weapons of terror to intimidate nations into accepting world government. Now, this is the policy which is expressed by, specifically, Brzezinski, most emphatically, and by the crowd associated with Mark Rich in both the Democratic Party and Republican parties. They are the go-to-war-now party. You have a second policy. It's an old policy, the old British policy, called liberal imperialism, which is expressed sometimes in the pages of the Washington Post by Michael Ignatieff, or by Cooper, the advisor to the British Prime Minister. The third model, which is mine, is might be called the community of principle policy. This is a traditional American policy, which was first articulated explicitly by Secretary of State John Quincy Adams in connection with the formulation of what became known as the Monroe Doctrine. The objective of the United States in the hemisphere, he proposed at that time in his letter to Monroe, is to keep the damn Europeans, colonialists, out of the country as much as possible. But we, the United States, did not have the power at that time to do it. But nonetheless, it should be our policy. Our policy is to, when we are able to defend the right of independence of sovereign republics of the Americas, and to establish a community of principle among what are respectively perfectly sovereign national republics, our policy of the hemisphere. I would propose that is should be our policy for the world today. In taking an assessment of the situations I know, there is no reason for the United States to plan major war in any part of this planet. There's no situation on this planet, as a major war situation, we could not control if it were just, because we could find support from other nations to make it effective. There is no need for our seeking war. We require a policy of strategic defense. I support Rangel, his proposal, for precisely that reason. It's a sensible, traditional American policy. We must be able to defend ourselves adequately and efficiently. As president, I would ensure that. And I don't think anybody would dare challenge me on that if I were president. I wouldn't have to bother fighting. I would just wink. We have reached the state, and this international financial crisis and all the other crises, like disease crisis and so forth, show us that the planet really has one common interest, or is coming to an understanding that we have but one common interest. However, the problem is that in order to have the participation of the people in the exercise of government and common interest, you must operate through the culture of a people. You must engage the people with their culture in participating in making the policies. You don't expect the people to secrete the policies. Today, we still have very backward people who are concerned with about their little affairs and very little about things about major affairs. We don't have many Jeanne d'Arcs among our populations who are willing to lay down their life if necessary for the sake of a principle. Our presidents who would even risk their impeachment for the sake of a principle. But we have people who are desperate, who need leadership, and will turn to people who have this quality, which Schiller called the sublime, who are dedicated, who have a sense of immortality. It doesn't mean to repeat that one time. I've said it before, often again, but it's important. This image of what do we mean by a sense of immortality? What does Shakespeare mean in that third act soliloquy of Hamlet? Where Hamlet says he's willing to go to war, he's willing to die, doesn't bother him. He's a swashbuckling killer, anyway, contrary to Laurence Olivier, one of the worst actors of the century. But he says, what happens when they shuffle off this mortal coil? What he's afraid of is immortality, not death. Therefore, he'd rather die than face immortality. Seems like a contradiction, but that's exactly what most people are like. Most people say, I've got to get pleasure in my lifetime. I got to get what I'm going to get in my lifetime. You know how I get when I don't get it. They think about little things. They don't think of themselves as having any real significance for coming generations or for past generations. I mean, we have people who suffered. Take the case of slavery in the United States. We have people who suffered slavery. It was not an economic problem. People of African descent. This was the denial of the right to be human, to be treated as human. We owe them something. Now, we can't give them anything. They're dead. But we owe them something. We owe them justice. We owe them the assurance that their descendants, because of this struggle, their descendants will now have that justice assured to them. The problem with politicians, like with the incumbent number 43, is simple. He's concerned about the next election. You don't have to worry about the next election. I'll take care of that. What he should be concerned about is the fact that he's going to die. Now, he says he's a Christian, or probably a fundamentalist. Well, fundamentally, he's not on the right track there. Because according to everything we know about morality, the nature of man, our interest in life is to treat it as the parable in the Testament says. Life is a talent. It's given to us. We are going to lose it anyway. We're all going to die. You have a talent. The important thing is how do you spend it? What's the result of spending it? That's the sense of immortality. If you have a sense that what you're doing is spending your talent, your life, to make as important as a contribution to the future of humanity as you can make, and to justification of the past, you don't have any problems. Since you're going to die anyway, what can they take away from you? A president of the United States in a time of crisis must have that sense of immortality. They must have confidence that what they're doing is going to shine in the memory of coming generations. Very few people in this society have developed to the point that they have that kind of sense of honor. When they're up against injustice, they will say, what do I have to do to get out of this? They don't say it's wrong or right. An honest man who has a sense of immortality will say either you're right or you're wrong. He said, well, we got the power. You better deal with us or we're going to crush you. Well, crush me, but as you did Jeanne d'Arc and other heroes. Crush me, but I will not betray what I am. I will not contaminate my sense of immortality. And when the citizens have that sense of determination, they can't be crushed. They'll win in the long run. The function of leaders is to adopt that sense of responsibility. I make no deals. If it's right, you get it. But I don't make any deals. So that's our problem. Now we got a little problem to worry about is for the final point. Homeland defense. This is a real piece of trash. Someone says white trash. Northern Virginia, for example. Now what happened with this cockeyed thing that came out of the administration on homeland defense? Does this contribute to our security? No, it does not. It's absolutely worthless. You have to understand what the problem is, and obviously the incumbent's attorney general is not very long on competence. He's long on opinion, especially of the racist variety, as we know, but on competence not. Let's take the case of terrorism, the name terrorism. What does it mean? Well, you have two types of terrorism. One is the terrorism which is opportunistic, which is may operate in an area on a fairly low level. The other is a very sophisticated operation which can be done only by powerful governments, with special agencies of powerful governments. In the case of the U.S.-Soviet conflict, that was there. You had the Soviet apparatus had very powerful capabilities. They were running against the United States and others, and the United States was doing returning the favor. But what's your first line of defense against terrorism? Law enforcement. Local law enforcement. For example, let's take Northern Virginia. What's the major security problem in Northern Virginia? Drug gangs. You want to organize crime? You want some cooperation in doing something funny? Try the drug crime. Try the drug gangs. What they've done is they've stripped away, in the name of Homeland Defense, they've stripped away that first line of defense, which is ordinary law enforcement and law enforcement intelligence. The second line of that is cooperation vertically as well as horizontally and to special state and federal agencies which cooperate with local agencies in certain areas. If you clean up and control drugs in an area, actually control it, you're going to cut a dent in the capability of crime as well as providing general security. Most nasty things that will happen in an area today, the worst of them, will generally come through the channel of the drugs. If not the drug pushers as such, it'll come through those dirty channels. And if you have good control over this problem in an area, you've got the first level. If you have good level of control on the federal, state, and local agencies, intelligence, criminal intelligence, you will find that you get the map of the situation fairly clearly. And you are going to minimize the opportunity to run something dirty in that territory or to have something happen that you won't know about. Mysterious crimes. Now, the problem here is the U.S. government has been completely hypocritical and dishonest on the question of drugs. We've had laws against drugs, but we've been running drug pushing. How do you think Brzezinski got the Afghanistan war going? Afghanistan is one of the traditional areas of drug production. It's a polluted area, in a sense, where local gang lords control drug production. The principal area through which the drugs are channeled is out through Pakistan. Pakistan is a semi-destroyed country which has not been functioning effectively since the breakup of Bangladesh and Pakistan back years ago. So Pakistan has now become a drug country. That is, the Pakistan military are essentially drug lords. They became this largely because of the United States and Britain, which, beginning with Brzezinski, used Pakistan as a way of running what became known as the Afghanistan War of the 1980s. This is done by agencies in part of the federal government. In assistance of this, the United States went to various Arab countries with a thesis that the Soviet Union was a terrible atheistic state and therefore dedicated Islamic people, many of these who had been associated with British intelligence operations, should dedicate their lives to going to Pakistan for invading Afghanistan to conduct this war. How was it financed? Drugs. So we created Osama bin Laden. We created what is called Al-Qaeda. The British had already done it, but we moved in a big way. Now we have a mammoth problem in Central Asia. Afghanistan is not going to be pacified at present. The United States accomplished net nothing in Pakistan. The United States drawn off someplace else was going to happen. The Pakistan military, which lives on drugs, is going to recreate the Taliban, who will come back out of the soil and take the whole place over again. So what did they accomplish? Some dead people? What's the map look like? Has the map been improved? Not at all. The map has been made worse. Why'd they attack the place? No reason. Nobody ever presented any proof of any substance of who actually did September 11th, 2001. No government has ever presented any proof of who did it. Now, I know there's some people in our government who are still investigating that matter quite seriously, but there's no expectation of something that can be reported in within a year or so. So we did it. It was done for the sake of Brzezinski-style policies. It's this other type of policy. Now let's look at South and Central America. Let's take Colombia. The United States is not serious about cutting drugs in Colombia. As some of you may know, I was running an operation. Guatemala asked me to come down, assist them in assessing a terrorist problem they had up in the mountain areas there in Guatemala. So I did an assessment. They gave me some facts. I gave them my interpretation of the facts. They said, well, we agree. What should we do about it? I said, well, I'm not going to do anything. You have to decide what you're going to do. So we sent a piggyback group of people down there to just sit by their side while they planned the operation and watched them how they did it. They did a test operation, which confirmed exactly what I thought. In that period, I made a presentation on dealing with drugs in the Americas to a Mexico City conference. And I found out it wasn't going to work because some of the Colombian generals, government factions, had cut a deal together with George Bush then, according to them, on Medellin giving some drug money to support the Contra operation. That's never been settled. I mean, 41 should probably talk about it sometime or something. But so we created the situation. We overthrew a government in Peru because it was the most efficient anti-drug force in all South America. We created conditions under which the cocaine generals, which had got rid of Bolivia, are in the process of trying to come back and take over Bolivia. We have an operation which the Moonies, which are not exactly pure on the drug question or arms trafficking question, have bought up large territory in Brazil on the border of Bolivia and also on the Bolivian side of the border, are setting up an operation under the cover of the World Wildlife Fund to destroy Brazil. And so on and so forth. The major problem here is that we are not serious about fighting drugs, of fighting the drug problem. Worse, that our government has knowingly used this just the way the United States government used Saddam Hussein for the war against Iran. So we create the problem. We have similar types of problems around the world. The technical name for this is variously irregular warfare, special warfare, or low-intensity warfare. We run these kinds of operations as governments. Various governments run these kinds of operations. They run them in the form of strikes. They run them in all kinds of forms. We've written about this thing. It's well known. People in intelligence, competent in intelligence, and competent in police intelligence work, can understand these things and take the proper precautions to detect them in operation and find ways of dealing with them. But that requires that you don't want a bunch of Nazi-like block watchers in every area saying, my neighbor's a terrorist. This is the most stupid thing ever conceived. More could be said on that, but that's the general nature of the thing. We have to get serious about realizing what security really is and stop inventing mythical enemies who really are not our enemies because we want to have somebody to shoot at for some crazy cockeyed reason. Therefore, I would say there's no need for the problems we have today, no need for their happening. But if we understand why they shouldn't have happened, as I've tried to indicate as succinctly as possible, we can fix the problems now and perhaps prevent them from recurring again in the future. Thank you very much.
Let me begin with a question that actually comes from a member of the professional staff of one of the congressional committees. And this is someone who works for someone in the Congressional Black Caucus. He says, Mr. LaRouche, every great leader in the United States, from Abraham Lincoln to Franklin Delano Roosevelt to the great Dr. Martin Luther King, has addressed the principle of the common good and the common welfare. Today, what all of us are witnessing is outright murder in the name of austerity. We have argued against it based on upholding that principle of the general welfare. You gave us a broad understanding of that during the course of the fight to save DC General Hospital. But today you seem to have added something to the view. You've actually said that from an economic standpoint, as well as from a moral standpoint, austerity is a bad policy. I'm perfectly capable of understanding and explaining why austerity is bad from a moral standpoint, but I'm wondering if you would say a bit more as to why, in fact, budget cutting is not a sound economic policy.
Again, we're back to the question of immortality. We are responsible for human beings, especially young ones, because as we develop young human beings, educate them, and so forth, and provide them opportunities, we determine largely what they can become. So, therefore, our job in society is not to balance a budget, it's not to do anything. We have to balance budgets in a certain way, but balancing a budget is not a moral standard. It's simply something you may have to do. Balancing the real budget is what quality of human beings are we creating? When you create austerity, let's take the HMO. What happens with this HMO business? What we're doing is we're looting people of the health care which is coming to them for the sake of enriching someone who's jumped in as a speculator to try to loot the health care system. Therefore, we are taking away their lives.
You're listening to EIR Talks. We'll return in a moment with a continuation of Lyndon LaRouche's State of the Union Address. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We continue with Lyndon LaRouche's State of the Union Address.
When our present educational system, which is not better not called an educational system, we are taking away people's lives. I see people who don't know anything about this planet. Young people who don't know anything about anything. They've been educated in talking about opinion. We don't teach history anymore. We teach current events. Let's talk about current events. Everybody has their opinion. Nobody knows anything. We all talked about it. We all agreed to disagree. Okay, everybody spoke. It's all good. That's education. No knowledge of science. No, our responsibility is not just to how we treat people as if they were cattle. Our responsibility is how we develop people, what we do about their self-development and development. First, there's no need for austerity, not in the sense it's being applied today. They may be saying you can be austere about not giving something, everybody a 24-room mansion. That may be not particularly bad. But to deprive people of a decent place to live. Look on the streets of Washington, D.C. What about the homeless in the nation's capital, for example? What kind of austerity is that? Now, the issue of austerity should be understood. The problem is the development of the individual person and the effects of what we do upon the children and grandchildren of the people we directly impact. It's the immortality. It's a sense of immortality. There's no justice on the basis of being an animal coming in and being treated fairly as if you were an animal in a cage. You're a human being. And a human being's fundamental interest is, whether they know it or not, is their investment in this sense of personal immortality. It does not mean that somebody's going to give them something because they beg for it. It means they've earned something. They've earned their immortality. They've earned it by doing something or living their lives in such a way that somebody in future generations is going to benefit. And they can sit in their grave, so to speak, and smile to say, I spent my talent well because these people live, because I helped to make it possible. That's the criterion. When you take that away from somebody, the right to have a sense of immortality, what you do is you make people more ignorant, less moral. They're capable of doing things they otherwise would not do on moral grounds. You have to set a standard, especially government. Government must set a standpoint of caring not just for the body, but also the soul of the individual. Not by teaching religion, but by doing the things which ensures you going into your grave, that you've spent your talent so that people in future generations are going to benefit, and your dead ancestors can be proud of what you did. And that's what the problem is. We have to run society from that standpoint of understanding the difference between a monkey and a man. And sometimes with these politicians, it is difficult, I admit, to tell the difference.
During the course of Mr. LaRouche's remarks, he made repeated references at various points to the role of the Moonies in the current administration. And as a result, I have about 30 questions here on this topic. Lynn, I'm going to try to summarize them. Basically, the questions fall into three basic groupings. One is the question as to the role of Reverend Moon and the Unification Church in the current policy of this administration toward Korea. Second is the role of the Unification Church in the Nation of Islam, and a question as to what could Minister Farrakhan possibly be thinking about. And the third is a question as to what the actual intention of the Moonies is. The nature of the question is this a religion or is it an intelligence operation, and what is its intent, and how shall we proceed on this? Is exposé sufficient to root this out?
The Moon operation is essentially an intelligence operation with a pseudo-religious covering. You remember the Korean War, which is and how NATO created the Moon cult. At the time, MacArthur, you remember, had the invasion of South Korea by North Korea had occurred. The government of South Korea had essentially ceased to exist. The United States was holding it perimeter around Busan on the southern tip of Korea. MacArthur made the famous Incheon landing, outflanking the Korea forces, North Korea forces, in the southern part of Korea. And by that outflanking operation, was able to drive these North Korean forces north. Then an operation was run to get rid of MacArthur. But the territory, the southern part of Korea, had been retaken as territory. And the concern was, now that the war was a NATO war, the first NATO war, in which the United States was a partner in NATO in running a war, the question was how to get this part of southern part of Korea self-organized and armed, so that with a marginal degree of U.S. military security, it could continue to hold territory. What they did is they went to certain people in Japan Now, in Japan, there are traditionally two factions to be concerned with. One was a pro-British faction, the other was the pro-American faction. The pro-British faction was associated with the Britain's efforts to, first of all, the plan emerging from the post-World War I naval power agreements, that Japan was an ally of Britain, and not only was an ally of Britain against the United States on the naval policy, but Japan and Britain had conspired to plan a naval joint naval operations to destroy the U.S. Navy. At that point, Japan's plan was that Japan's fleet would attack the naval base at Pearl Harbor in a surprise attack. Now, this is from the beginning of the 1920s. Now, this was the case of General Billy Mitchell is key to this, because Billy Mitchell, being on the inside of knowing what war plan red and orange were, said that if the United States will build carriers, we from carriers could sink Japanese battleships attacking Pearl Harbor. The pro-British faction inside the U.S. Navy didn't like that, and so they forced the court-martial of Billy Mitchell. Now, the faction behind the First and Second Sino-Japanese War in Japan were the controllers of the Japanese occupation forces in Korea. So the NATO forces went to lease family interests in financial interests in Japan and Korea, their partners in Korea, and set up what became the right-wing tendency in the South Korean government. As a byproduct of this, an institution was created called the KCIA. The KCIA, in turn, recruited a cover from a sex pervert, Sun Yat-moon, who had a strange thing with young female parishioners, which was part of his religious service. I mean, this is the kind of service you expect from a bull, but not from a preacher. So you had this front operation, which went through various phases and still operates under this wildly Gnostic cover. It's a completely unstable thing, and Moon, I don't think, is very intelligent or anything else. He's a puppet. The real part of this is it's an intelligence operation. All right, it's an intelligence operation, essentially. And it is involved in arms trafficking and drug trafficking. It also has been recently caught by us in being part of the fundraisers from the United States who are supporting the Sharon government financially under an Israeli cover. So these guys are part of the problem. Look at what they run with this Washington Times. What is it? How many billions, how much money has it lost in running this propaganda operation in Washington, D.C.? What it's done in terms of the Nation of Islam and others is move in under the cover of this legislation, of this voluntary contributions legislation, to take away money from people that usually expect money. And by the aid of McCain and Lieberman, they've taken away money, soft money, from the political parties, all to the benefit of McCain and Lieberman for their bull moose conspiracy for the year 2004. So under this kind of business, the Moonies moved in as on a opportunity with the money which they have from indicated sources. And this was always, in my time when I was working on this STI in 1982-83 and beyond even, this was one of the problems we were up against. I would meet with people in the National Security Council, so-called one end of the National Security Council, the people associated with Clark, who was then the National Security Advisor. At the other end of the hall, there was Ollie North and company, with all the funny, crawly creepies. And so, therefore, I know this operation fairly well, and I was been told many times about what Colonel Bohee Park means for the U.S. irregular operations. It's an intelligence operation, and it's an intelligence operation against the interior of the United States. It should stop.
Mr. LaRouche, this is from an elected official. Mr. LaRouche, I came into public office as a product of the civil rights movement. I represent people in what probably qualifies as one of the poorest districts in the United States. Most of my constituents are very reluctant to trust any white man, let alone George Bush. In the course of your remarks, you repeatedly refer to what Bush should do, and you certainly indicate that you would work with him to accomplish these things. But the fact is that I simply don't think my constituents will go along with it. It's also the case that although my community is poor in terms of capital, it is not poor in terms of human capital. We have many young black men and women who are intellectuals, who know you, and they trust you as I do. So I'm asking you to do me a favor and to speak to them directly, because I really can't convince them as to why they should not simply oppose everything that this president says and does.
Well, that's the way you deal with people, you see. It's called strategic defense. If you want to get somebody to do something, I mean, George Bush needs me. I'm not offering to work for him, but he needs me because this country has problems and he has problems that he can't solve. I know the solutions. So therefore, maybe we got a little trade-off here. That if he listened to me, I don't want anything in return. I just want him to do some good things. And he can take the credit for it if he does them. But if he doesn't, he's got to reckon with me. Because we've got to be realistic in the sense that we've got people dying around the world. We've got the danger of a Hitler-like phenomenon coming out of something like an Iraq war. And that's what it could mean. If we start down the road toward war, we don't know where it's going to end. There's no need for this war. There's no sense to it. There's no excuse for it. But it could lead to a terrible situation in a highly inflammable world at a time that the alternatives are good ones for agreements. So therefore, I have to get these results now. I have to get results from U.S. official institutions. The parties, as I think most people, as you who asked the question know, is pretty much worthless at the moment. We've got some decent fellows here, but they're not willing to play the role they must play to get the job done. In the meantime, the executive powers of the government under our system reside in the presidency as an institution, not in the person of the president, but in the presidency, in that the sitting president has a certain function. He must be induced to play that function. And he must have several kinds of inducements. One are the soft ones, the others are the hard ones. And the presidency can put very tough conditions upon a sitting president. And when I'm saying I'm going to get George Bush out of his mess, I'm not saving him, I'm trying to save the United States. And I have to do it. There's no other way to do it in this 2-year period. I have to do it. And I'm putting the pressure not on the president. I'm putting the pressure on the presidency. I'm putting the pressure on those institutions of government, the retired people around government, who have the power to push something. And I'm saying push. Make this guy do it any way you have to get him to convince him to do it. But let him know there is a reward in it. If he does it, he'll get safely through the next 2 years. Without being impeached or something terrible. No guarantee beyond that point. All we want from him is, he wants his place in immortality, we'll give it to him. But he's got to do what we want, what we need. It's the only way to do it. And it's true, I will be talking to people as I can. And of course, when you're campaigning with a country of somewhat less than 300 million people, and also campaigning around the world, in Europe, in Asia, and so forth, as I'm doing right now. I'm already acting as the president. I'm all over the world. Don't stay in the White House. Let them clean it out once in a while. But I think my exemplary meetings with typical people in various constituencies is going to be important in this period, and I'll take this thing up. Anybody wants to take me rake me over the coals over this, they can rake me over the coals over it. If you want me to do that, I'll do that.
As many people know, Mr. LaRouche has committed himself to build a youth movement in the United States and globally, not only as part of his commitment to the future, but also because they represent an unpredictable and unstoppable light cavalry, which is critical in this current period. We have questions that have come in from youth from all over the world as they listen to Mr. LaRouche's remarks. What I'm going to do in closing is to try to summarize the question that they seem to be submitting most frequently. It's an easy question for Lynn. It says, in talking to young people, the most frequent question that I'm confronted with is not that people disagree with what I'm saying, but people say, what can I do? I'm just one person in a completely backward and seemingly unstoppable global collapse. I happen to think that one person actually can do something. But I'd like to know, what do you see as the most immediate difference that one individual can make at this time and why? I guess what I'm really asking is, what is the soul and how can you know it? What is the soul? It seems to be something a U.S. president should know.
I think it bears repeating, though I've said it often before and written about it a great deal, about this question of the soul and spiritual. We go back to science a bit. You see, we should not have religion and state mixed up in any way. But it's not necessary to say, I've learned it from a Bible, I've learned it from a preacher. That doesn't mean anything. Because that's learning, that's not knowledge. Yeah? And people are taken in when religion starts saying, teaching learning rather than knowledge, it becomes dangerous because it denies people their soul. And that's a lousy religion that takes people's souls away from them and gives them a free ticket on a non-existent place in a non-existent heaven. It's sort of like a moon trip, you know. We can know the proof of the existence of God as a creator. We can verify things as a matter of knowledge by the same principle which developed by Plato in his collection of Socratic dialogues and his supplementary piece on the laws. You have the famous piece by Moses Mendelssohn, which is a study of the significance of Plato's Phaedo, called the Phaedon, by Moses Mendelssohn, which is an example of this. We have the ability to have certain knowledge of things that some people call spiritual, religious, and so forth, without relying on any particular teaching, book, or anything else. We can know that. The same way that we know any other principle, like I just illustrated crudely, this of the principle of gravitation. You find a contradiction in what the senses teach you. And you solve the contradiction and you demonstrate experimentally that you found the solution. This becomes known as a universal principle. Well, what's this question of the soul, which is dealt with so admirably by Plato and by Moses Mendelssohn? Huh? One should read these things and study them, because one should know rather than learn. We have too much learning and not enough knowledge. All right, now we have a fellow called Vernadsky. Great man, dead, didn't know everything, but he made a very useful contribution, a fundamental contribution to humanity, with his concept of the biosphere and noosphere. What he did simply was demonstrate, as a physical chemist, he demonstrated that the principle which Pasteur pointed toward, which Curie defined and Vernadsky studied with Curie, that life is a principle separate from abiotic universe, but that it interacts with the abiotic universe. In other words, life intervenes in the universe to transform the universe. He demonstrated that as a principle of life. Secondly, that mankind, by his ability to make discoveries of principle and intervene in the biosphere through that knowledge, is able to change the universe in ways that the universe could otherwise not change itself. And through this, man increases his power to exist in and over the universe and incurs responsibilities for the universe which are commensurate with his knowledge. Therefore, we know that discovery, Platonic principle of hypothesis, is a universal physical principle in the universe because it is physically efficient in the universe, in changing the universe. Therefore, we call this quality, as distinct from life, which we share with the animals, we call this quality of discovery, distinct from mere life, as spiritual. And the spiritual quality, which has permanent effects upon the universe around us, continues after we're dead, through the ideas that we have brought into play in humanity through discovery. Thus we recognize, because this, the nature of the personality of this process of discovery, that it's only done by sovereign individuals, that the creator whom we imitate is also a sovereign individual. So you know it. I've made it brief, but that you know it. You know the soul. Unless you are Norbert Wiener, or John von Neumann, or Bertrand Russell, who deny the existence of the soul. Obviously, they have no souls, the poor creatures. I wonder what kind of a biological specimen they are. We don't want one of those in our family. So anyway, so the point is, it's a matter of knowledge. Now, once you have a sense of that, a sense that spiritual is not something tells you, you know, there's God up there. What do you mean, God's up there? I don't see him. But once you know what you mean, and know it as a scientific certainty, then you have the knowledge of these matters which the state must have, which government must have. Government does not need to be taught by preachers, particularly the type that can be bought cheaply by Boone. We don't need that. Government must be taught the way I've indicated, to know the truth. And when anyone comes to them from any religious profession and says to them, with this, you say, wait a minute, I, as government, will act only on what I know to be true, or what I should know to be true. And if I don't know it, I shouldn't be in government. So government is actually a sacred responsibility, because it's based on a comprehension and responsiveness to universal principles which are otherwise known by the name creator or God, or known as spirituality or individual soul. And the person who does not know that is not qualified to govern, because they haven't learned the first step about government. Govern yourself.
You have been an extraordinary audience, and I'm sure that you feel privileged, as I do, in having participated in this historic event. The full transcript of today's proceedings will be posted on the internet, hopefully by tomorrow morning. We intend to move very rapidly into publication with a transcript of these proceedings. We will count on all of you to help in the distribution of that. And really, I guess at this time, what I would like to do is to ask you to join me in thanking Mr. LaRouche for this extraordinary address.
You've been listening to EIR Talk's presentation of Lyndon LaRouche's State of the Union Address. To hear a rebroadcast or to read a transcript, go to www.larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.